versus Batras. Captain McHenry, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes.
And Captain Miller, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes.
Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. Appellant, respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The military judge plainly erred when he sentenced appellant to consecutive sentences for 3 offenses involving the same victim and the same transaction in apparent disregard of the clear mandate of shall found in RCM 1002, sentencing determination. I would like to begin by offering the court 3 standards by which it can recognize a transaction for purposes of applying it to the specific context of the sentencing rules. First, from Baker, a transaction is generally construed to embrace a series of occurrences or an aggregate of acts which are logically related to a single course of criminal conduct. Second, in cases where joinder is permitted, we can compare the language described as where crimes share the same victim and location and occur sufficiently close in time so that a reasonable person would easily recognize the common factual elements that permit joinder. And third, borrowing additional factors from this court's jurisprudence in unreasonable multiplication of charges as applied to findings, language such as united in time, place, and circumstance, and single impulse. So those are some standards by which we can recognize a transaction which both the Army Court opinions recognize as a flexible term that is context-dependent.
So, Captain McHenry, you just acknowledged, and you did in your brief as well, that we're issue is forfeited, so we're doing plain error. And you're citing to Baker right now, as you did in your briefs. And Baker doesn't just give the definition that you just provided. It also says that transaction has a flexible meaning. So if we, at this level, are looking at whether there was clear or obvious error, and transaction has a flexible meaning, how are you going to surmount that burden or hurdle?
Your Honor, I think because the term has a flexible meaning, I think within context, the specific context and the broader statutory context, a flexible term can still have a clear meaning. A few years ago, the Supreme Court in Dubin tried to evaluate the meaning of a phrase in relation to, and they found that it was also particularly sensitive to context. I think that defining transaction is possible, and I think both the Army Court opinions kind of give up a little too early in trying to define a transaction. The case law does refer to transactions as being turning on timing in many cases, and short time periods, more indicative of a single transaction. The word transaction is used often with synonyms, and those most clearly refer to time. So Senior Judge Walker, her dissent refers to a process or an encounter. We have a case from the CMA called Vidal that calls these facts a continuous transaction. The U.S. sentencing guidelines talk about an episode or a single criminal episode. Sneezer talks about an occurrence. Baker refers to this aggregate of acts, of course. Bivens talks about instances, separate instances of harms that a victim must face anew.
Captain McHenry, getting back to Chief Judge Olson's question, though.
Yes.
Isn't it kind of the reason why you would want to encourage counsel to address this issue down at the trial level? In other words, how does it be, I think he might be asking, but if he's not, I'm asking, how does this become clear and obvious if there's this flexibility allowed and all we have is the military judge's determination based on what he or she is hearing and deciding at the trial? I mean, isn't that the place to make a claim that the military judge should have looked at this as one transaction instead of two?
Your Honor, this is a novel issue, so, of course.
I'm not asking you to concede your whole case.
Yeah.
But, I'm just wondering, though, isn't that a logical place and a logical reason for encouraging counsel on an issue like this at sentencing, prior to the judge giving the sentencing or after the judge issues the sentence, saying, hey, wait a minute, judge, you're running these sentences consecutively. Here's the reason why you should not.
Yes, Your Honor, we can expect that of a defense counsel, but we can also expect that of the military judge. I think on facts like these that so clearly implicate this same transaction language and same victim language.
Maybe the military judge was not looking at necessarily the same victim, but the moment the scenario shifted from a consensual interaction between appellant and the victim suddenly to a non-consensual encounter with this other character who enters the scene. Why can't the military judge look at it from that point? And maybe that's what happened, but we don't know because there was no objection at trial.
There was no objection, Your Honor. Of course, one of the cases that the government cites, the majority opinion that the Army Court cites, is McCrimmon. It talks about plain error should not be applied as stringently in the sentencing context because the cost of correcting an unpreserved error is not as great as in the trial context.
Well, plain error generally is supposed to be used rather sparingly, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because we want people to address issues at the trial when it is best, when the parties and the judge are best able to address the issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean,
you don't disagree with me on any of that? I understand. I'm not trying to put you in a box.
Right.
I hear you.
Well, counsel, because before we get too far, I want to make sure that I'm tracking which standard of review you're applying to what. Mm-hmm. So when you're arguing plain error, because in your briefs you argued that plain error standard should apply to the military judge's determination that it was only one transaction, as opposed to government arguing abuse of discretion. But plain error also could apply to the standard that the CCA used in reviewing the military judge's action. So I just want to make sure I'm tracking which plain error we're talking about at this point, because you segued into the substantial harm, and Judge Sparks's questions are going to the substantial, transaction substantial harm test.
Admittedly, Your Honor, the standards of review here do tend to run together a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The overall standard is de novo. It's an interpretation of the RCM. Applying the facts to the law, a legal conclusion is de novo. But here, and maybe the findings of fact that the military judge made would be given an abuse of discretion standard. But here, the military judge did not make any findings of fact. And the facts are largely uncontroverted. If you read the three testimonies of the three participants in the joint appendix, they largely track each other. And
was the military judge required? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just wondering on what you just said. Was the military judge required to make findings of fact in the absence of an objection?
Your Honor, currently there's no requirement that the military judge make findings of fact in this area. But seeing as it touches so clearly on a rule for court-martial that includes the language shall, I think it would behoove the military judge to demonstrate an awareness and a balancing of 1002D with 1002F, rather than just being silent. The silence leads to a situation where the majority at the Army Court had to credit the military judge for his inherent findings, which are very difficult to review. It's very difficult to review an inherent finding. It's also difficult to enforce segmented sentencing and ensure that judges are determining an appropriate sentence for each specification first and only then deciding whether they should run concurrently or consecutively.
Counsel, could you help me understand the relationship between the requirement that if it's the same transaction, the sentence is run concurrently, and then also the requirement that or the provision saying a judge should take into account unreasonable multiplication of charges for the purpose of sentencing. Because it would seem like an unusual case where it wouldn't be unreasonable multiplication of charges for sentencing, but then you have to run the sentences concurrently. But the tests seem to be almost the same. To put it in just more concretely, was this an unreasonable multiplication of charges for sentencing in this case? I mean, could that be just another way of looking at it, that he shouldn't have been sentenced for three different offenses?
Your Honor, that is an alternative way I think you could look at this case, especially with regard to the assault consummated by a battery. Very clearly was done in furtherance of the sexual assault by and for no other purpose. So there you could say two different statutes that he was convicted of for the same act. But we are arguing that this rule is clear enough on its own that it's separate from unreasonable multiplication of charges, even though it is useful to kind of borrow from that area because it is closely related.
I'm still having a hard time, though, understanding, you know, how it could be that they have to run concurrently, but it's not an unreasonable multiplication of charges for sentencing. I mean, it's just, it doesn't necessarily affect your case. I'm just, anything that we say about the one provision is going to affect the interpretation of the other. It's not a big question there.
Yes, Your Honor. Sort of sorting out the various areas of law here is challenging. I agree with Your Honor.
Let's get down to the nitty-gritty.
Yes, sir.
We're trying to figure out what the word transaction means.
Correct.
My concern is that at the end of the day, whatever this court writes, the military judges are going to say, thanks a lot, Kath. We went from the word transaction to gobbledygook. How do we get out of that bind? How do we get out of that box? You've gone through, understandably, this is not intended as a criticism, but you've gone through a number of different things talking about the Baker definition, joinder, unreasonable multiplication of charges, same time, place, victim, impulse, mm-hmm. so forth. What should this court be doing in terms of providing guidance to the field about what the word transaction means?
Your Honor, from case law, we can assess that a transaction means at least two acts. Otherwise, the word is meaningless. We can also see a thread that involves timing. It's still unclear, but in Sneezer, it was a few minutes. The general rules taken from the sentencing guidelines talk about grouping offenses that occur on the same day. Location is a factor. But I think what you see in Wise and other cases is it's fact dependent. So making these determinations really is difficult to put out a clear rule. I think factors are useful. But we know that a transaction has a time component to it, and there's more than one act permitted. And the only thing in the facts here, you have the same everything, basically, except for the fact that there are two offenders. The majority court opinion at ACCA cites trailer as for the proposition that it was reasonable to conclude that these were different harms because there were two people. But trailer is about guilt or innocence. It's about whether there was consent or not. It's not about the sentencing rules at all.
Is distinct harms a factor that could be considered?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why wouldn't it be reasonable to say, look, the victim was injured in three different parts of her body here, so there are three different harms?
This is where, Your Honor, the Sneezer Court talks about the inherent artificiality in kind of interpreting these sentencing guidelines. And it acknowledges that, in concrete terms, every harm suffered by a victim is separate and no two acts are the same. But for purposes of the sentencing rules, we group offenses when they cause substantially the same harm. And some of the examples it gives are about, you know, someone fleeing the police and shooting twice. or someone robbing a store and then coming back to rob the same store 2 minutes later. Those are different acts, but for sentencing purposes, we're going to call them substantially the same.
But counsel, to go back, and I'm back on Chiefs on transaction, I'm on standards of review. So as you just noted, this is a factually dependent, a fact-heavy determination. And generally, when we are in that realm, then we are looking at a military judge's actions for an abuse of discretion, and we grant them significant deference as a result of that. So why in this instance would we, since military judges presume to know and apply the law, why would we not grant the military judge the deference to make that determination based upon the facts that were elicited? You know, as Judge Maggs just said, you have, why couldn't this be three distinct harms? Because you had three distinct acts that occurred.
Your Honor, because RCM 1002 D2B little I, it doesn't mention harm. It mentions the same victim and the same act or transaction. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, but in defining transaction, what you just posited, or in response to Judge Maggs' question, that yes, distinct harm could be part of that test.
Well, I may have misspoken there, but I think it does appear in the case law and in some of the language in the guidelines that are adopted by the MJIRG, and you know, harm is weighed and looked at, but the dissenting opinion from Senior Judge Walker, it acknowledges the possibility that different acts can have substantially the same harm. The majority opinion says that it was reasonable for the judge to find two harms, they were separate. But that's always going to be the case, that two harms have two separate impacts if you're the victim. But we're just talking about something from the offender's perspective because it's a sentencing determination. So from the appellant's perspective, it's one transaction. But from the victim's perspective, it's also one transaction. So from the victim's perspective, they're still seeing, you know, justice carry out as if there were, in the abstract, two transactions. But we're just trying to apply the sentencing fairly to avoid appellant facing extremely long minimum maximum sentences, because multiple sexual acts can be committed over a small period of time using the same impulse. And I think the President's guidance in using the language of shall is that making those kinds of decisions on one impulse with no time to sort of back out isn't meant to sort of double and triple and quadruple the maximum punishments. And then with two offenders present where they're helping each other, you go from potentially doubling and tripling to just exponential increases in the maximum punishments. Oh, I see my time has expired.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain McHenry. Captain Miller?
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Stuart Miller, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, represent the United States. The military judge announced a segmented sentence that complied fully with the requirements of Article 56 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Can you please pull the microphone to
it? Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. That fully complied with Article 56 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, as well as Rule for Court-Martial 1002 Delta 2 Bravo. The military judge's announcement of consecutive terms of confinement provides his implied or inherent finding that the specifications did not involve the same act or transaction. To quote the Army Court, by making the terms of confinement consecutive, the military judge inherently found appellant's two offenses caused separate and distinct instances of harm to the victim, a finding that is reasonable under the facts of appellant's case. Where there was no reasoning placed on the record, because defense counsel neither objected to the announcement of the maximum potential sentence that appellant faced, nor did appellant object to the announcement of consecutive terms of confinement, the record contains none of the military judge's reasoning. However, this court can and should still afford the military judge the presumption that he knew and followed the law, absent evidence to the contrary, which here there is none. There was no plain error, and if this court disagrees, it should not find any error to be plain or obvious, especially where the first time this issue was affirmatively raised was in a specified briefing order from the Army Court. It was not preserved by defense counsel at trial, nor was it affirmatively raised by appellate defense counsel in their Article 66 appeal. The Army Court properly conducted statutory interpretation consistent with this court's recent opinion in United States versus Valentin Andino. They looked at the terms act, transaction. They resolved the definitions of those, acknowledging that transaction was a more difficult term to define in the greater context of RCM 1002 Delta 2 Bravo Numeret 1.
Counsel, in its opinion below, the CCA decided that Baker wasn't controlling because it dealt with unreasonable multiplication of charges. But as Judge Maggs pointed out a few minutes ago, it's awfully hard to see the difference between unreasonable multiplication of charges and what we're dealing with here with the sentencing issue. That seems like it. Why was that not too thin of a read to dismiss Baker, which is, I think, the most on-point case we have for providing a definition for a transaction?
So, Your Honor, with Baker being an unreasonable multiplication of charges case, the intent of unreasonable multiplication of charges, which is to hinder or kind of protect from prosecutorial overreach, is distinctly different from a factual finding that a series of convictions involve the same victim and the same actor transaction.
Is that a fact finding? Or are you asserting that that's a fact finding?
Your Honor, I believe
it seems like that could just as easily be a question of law.
I believe it's likely a mixed question, Your Honor, with respect to both the statutory interpretation and the necessary facts that a military judge would need to make to support a decision to run sentences concurrently or consecutively.
So here we have no facts, right? We just have the conclusion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. But anyway, go ahead.
But yes, and there's helpful language in Baker that can.
Well, it's not just helpful. They define transaction, right? They give us a definition. I couldn't find any other cases where we get a definition of transaction.
Yes, Your Honor. In looking at the factors that Baker used to discuss when things will be out of a single transaction and comparing them to the specifications for which appellant was convicted here, we don't have a case where any of these specifications were a lesser included. And here, looking at the
language. All right, but you just said a minute ago that the purpose of unreasonable, even these are lawful charges, right, and lawful convictions. We can slice and dice the malfeasance into these little crimes and convict someone. The Constitution allows it. But the concept behind unreasonable multiplication of charges is it's just not fair, right? This is unreasonable, so we're not going to let the government do it. I don't see how that's any different than what is going on with the sentencing here, where we say, look, it might be constitutional that the government slice and dice this malfeasance into these discrete offenses, but to protect defendants, we're going to make the sentences run concurrently if it's all part of the same transaction, right? So I guess I don't see, you said they were very distinct in their purpose, but I guess I need you to explain that to me, because I don't see how they're that different in their purpose.
So, Your Honor, in looking at the language from Baker about when offenses are in a single transaction, one of the terms used is when they're not indivisible of each other. And the government's position is that here, with the victim, it's the same victim in all three specifications. There's no doubt about that. It's separate acts. There's no doubt about that. So in looking at whether this transaction caused distinct and separate harm, and whether those harms are divisible from one another, is the government's position as to how numerate 1 would be applied here and how that's distinguishable from a UMC analysis under Kuros.
Counsel, can you talk more about the harms? I mean, appellant defense counsel says, look, transaction must involve more than one act, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. So you're always going to have two acts, and any time you have a separate act, you're going to have a separate harm. It can't just be a test, was there multiple harms, because that's just really a test of whether there are multiple acts, and that can't be the test for whether there's the same transaction.
No, Your Honor, and that's where I think the substantially same harm language comes in. It's not that these are merely different, you know, a punch to the top of the head and under the jaw in a series of 128 convictions, but rather are they substantially the same? And the government's position is that here they are not. that the sexual act of appellant sexually assaulting the victim, the sexual act wherein he caused the victim to be sexually assaulted by, and then the physical assault, which resulted in a bodily harm that is distinct from the sexual acts of the 120 specifications for which he was convicted, are all distinct and substantially different harms than each other. So it goes to that substantialness of the similarity, Your Honor, not the mere fact that these are, in fact, different harms.
Counsel, are you familiar with Wooden versus United States, a Supreme Court decision from 2022? You didn't cite it in your brief, and the government didn't. I mean, the appellant didn't either, so it's okay if you're not. But
I'm not, Your Honor.
All right, so you're just going to have to take my word for it. So this is a case from a couple years ago from the Supreme Court. It dealt with the term occurrence, which is different than transaction. Occasion. I misspoke. It dealt with occasion instead of transaction. But it was basically a sentencing enhancement problem. Whether a criminal defendant's crimes all occurred on the same occasion would result in more severe sentencing or not. And the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, issued a series of, you can pick out, 7 or 8 factors that a court should consider in considering whether or not something was in the same occasion. Is that something, since we don't, if we accept the assertion that Baker doesn't really control here, is that something that should guide us in our review of whether or not something is in the same transaction? Is that case analogous, or is that distinct enough, a different statute, it's the Armed Career Criminal Act, a different word, occasion instead of transaction, that it's not really relevant to this case?
So, Your Honor, having not reviewed that case, I'm at a disadvantage for offering the government's position on how useful it may be. My inclination would be that their reasoning would likely be of some assistance to this Court insofar as there's factual similarities between the issues. But, again, having not read the case, I can't offer the government's position on that.
Fair enough.
But ultimately, this case is reviewed for plain error. Again, the military judge.
Before you go on to that, so I'm just wondering whether we're pushing the issue of what transaction means down the line. So if we're looking at same time, place, victim, impulse, and then we say substantially the same harm, how do we give guidance to the military judges about what substantially same harm means?
So, Your Honor, I believe that may be an area where the military judge is able to exercise that broad discretion that they are given under Rule for Court-Martial 1002 in Article 56 to make a determination on whether sentences should be run consecutively or concurrently. And in that's just an area that will guide their exercise of that broad discretion that they have to determine an appropriate sentence.
So is it the government's position then that we should not try to further define what the word or the phrase substantially same harm means?
No, Your Honor, I believe that this Court can do so.
Then how should we do so?
I would have to supplement my brief, Your Honor, on that issue. I believe that the Army Court's opinion in looking at the factual distinctions of the offenses and the harm that they caused the victim under a reasonableness standard, looking at the military judge's findings and whether they were reasonable based off the existence of substantially the same harm, ultimately supports leaving that to the military judge to decide, though.
And we would review that decision, the standard review of that decision would be what your argument is?
If it had been preserved, Your Honor,
mm-hmm.
for an abuse of discretion,
okay.
There would have been, whether it's mixed findings of law and fact or pure findings of fact, this Court would be looking at it through the lens of an abuse of discretion where the issue had been preserved at the trial level. And the Service Court of Appeals would also be applying that standard. Otherwise, we would be in the standard that we're in here, a plain error, which, in Your Honor's questions to defense counsel, you acknowledged the existence of a flexible meaning. And Judge Sparks, you acknowledged the fact that no counsel had brought this up at any point. So here, the plain error standard, this Court should find, is significantly high for those reasons, that the military judge operated within the discretion afforded to him pursuant to the rule for court-martial, that he demonstrated his knowledge and compliance with the rule for
court. Can you just bring the microphone closer to you again?
I apologize, Your Honor. And that he demonstrated compliance with both the Article 56 of the UCMJ and the requisite rule for court-martial by engaging in segmented sentencing and announcing the consecutive nature of the terms of confinement. So if there's any error here, it's certainly not plain. Pending any...
What should we say about the meaning of substantially the same harm? I mean, if we say, well, one of the factors to be considered is whether it's substantially the same harm, and we don't find a clear error here, do we have to say anything more, though, about what we mean by substantially the same harm?
So, Your Honor, I do believe that the doctrines of multiplicity and UMC would pick up wherever any deficiencies with this respective analysis would fall. Because, again, those are distinct doctrines that look at very similar issues, none of which were raised here. So the analysis for whether offenses create a double jeopardy issue or a prosecutorial overreach issue are fully addressed by these other doctrines. So ultimately, leaving substantially the same harm as something for the military judge to determine would be proper.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. And this court should affirm the findings of the Army Court.
Thank you, Captain Miller. Captain McHenry.
On the topic of plain error, the government cited, or the Army majority cites Nadeau and McCrimmon, which find that in evaluating procedural and substantive reasonableness, that procedural miscalculations based on the guidelines do meet the standard for prejudice or the third prong in plain error. So here we would argue that overlooking 1002D, same actor transaction, is akin to a miscalculation of the sentence. Regarding substantially the same harm, Sneezer and other cases really emphasize the timing, but also the timing plus other factors, I think, is the main way to distinguish whether harms are substantially the same or not. And then I may have misheard, but Valentin Andino talked about the definitions of appropriate and meaningful relief, not about the definitions of act or transaction. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in Valentin Andino, this court refused to create a rule out of thin air requiring the CCA to explain why meaningful relief was inappropriate under the circumstances. Here the court would not be creating a rule out of thin air, but simply using its powers of de novo review to enforce 1002D2B little I according to its own terms. Pending any further court...
Absolutely. Could you please revisit the very first point you made when you came to the podium? What was your point about surmounting plain error review?
Since we talked a lot about plain error here and the lack of objection, and if we're in plain error, we have to show prejudice or an effect on appellant's substantial rights. And in McCrimmon, they found that where a trial court committed an error in its guidelines calculation, that did affect appellant's substantial rights.
Counsel, do you have a view on whether the determination that whether the offenses were the same act or transaction or not is a factual determination by the military judge or a question of law?
Ultimately, Your Honor, it's a legal conclusion, so we view it as a question of law, but heavily influenced by the facts. Which is why I think it's important for a judge to acknowledge an awareness of it and to make factual findings rather than remain silent and simply be credited for fashioning an overall sentence.
You may briefly conclude if you wish.
That's all, Your Honor. Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.